Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, the video gaming industry is worth over $20 billion in the U.S. economy and growing at over four times the annual U.S. GDP growth rate. My guest today will be one of the keynote speakers for the Heartland Gaming Expo this Saturday at the Reynolds Center. Lenny Moore has been an accomplished composer, orchestrator, and arranger of music for video games, films, television, and new media. His credits include titles in the Halo franchise, Star Wars, and The New Republic, Outcast, his first video game project in 1999, and The Walking Dead motion comic and Watchmen motion comic. He currently teaches in the technology and applied composition area of the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, and also teaches scoring video games for UCLA, and formerly taught in the USC Music Department. He's currently a visiting artist at the University of Tulsa, workshopping with music, film studies, and video gaming students, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He'll be featured at 4:30 this Saturday at the Heartland Gaming Expo, going on all day Saturday at the Reynolds Center. Lenny Moore, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Lenny, since you started in the industry, probably at the time when you first started working probably as a copyist and an orchestrator, you're still doing things on pen and paper, and today you're teaching at San Francisco Conservatory of Music, involving every aspect of technology and applied in producing compositions today. How has the industry changed for a composer, say, from the early 80s to today?
Yeah, it's kind of an exciting generation. I was talking with a friend of mine from Los Angeles, a session guitarist, and we were talking about how great our career time frame has been since the early 80s up until now. So when I was at Berklee College of Music in Boston, in like 1980 to 83, MIDI wasn't invented yet. So, for those people that don't know what MIDI is, it's the controlling information that you use a computer to record what you play on an electronic keyboard to record into your computer like a tape recorder. And so that wasn't invented yet. What we call a DAW, or digital audio workstation, where you can actually create music within a computer, that didn't exist. It was all pencil and paper or pen and paper. I still remember my Pelican, special nib pen and all the indie ink and all that kind of stuff, and having my hands just full of ink and having sponges around to blot up stuff. And
anybody who was a copyist, you could always tell who they are because their hands were sort of had a blackish hue to them.
There was definitely the blackish hue. It was the equivalent of like when a car mechanic comes home at the end of a day of work, there's grease and stuff like that on their fingers. And for copyists or people that were composing at the time, pencil lead on the palm of your hand all the time, eraser bits everywhere, and ink stains. And to me, it's still something I still incorporate in my composition practice. I still sketch on paper before I actually plug everything in to the computers when I'm composing. For me, there's something tactile about having bits of eraser everywhere and having the graphite on my hands and being able to move paper around in a space which, as cool as the digital tools are, they don't quite simulate that for me. I can't really take a piece of paper and go, I've got an idea for the end of a piece, so therefore I'm going to grab that piece of paper and move it in front of me, work on it, and then, there's something at the beginning, and flip back and forth on a computer to scroll through pages of information. It's a very different kind of experience. It's not moving it around a three-dimensional space. And although we've got right now another technological advance that's being developed on a high level, which is virtual reality and AR is the acronym. It's
artificial.
It's not artificial reality, but it's an enhancement. So the idea is that you can wear. It's kind of like the Google glasses that they were developing a few years ago. So there's a lot of stuff going on where you can just wear. It's a glasses that'll project something in front of you, so you can be a surgeon looking at a patient. But then there's a digital projection of something like what your
the technique you're going to use or whatever.
Yeah, if you're doing one of those little micro cameras inside of a patient and you're doing some heart surgery or something like that, you can see all that information through your glasses.
And musicians and composers are using this, starting to use this?
I was just at the Game Developer Conference a few weeks back, and that was one of the huge things was the virtual reality and the AR kind of component, which is, it's so funny. I'm such a geeky computer guy, and I can't remember what AR stands for.
That's all right. But this whole arc of technology has utterly changed the field. I mean, in the way for music, just production of music, I mean, it rivals the invention of the piano, or, you know, I mean, it's like been a sea change.
Yeah, totally. And
perhaps
also,
even greater than the invention of any instrument.
I don't know about greater. I mean, you know, you look at a Stradivarius violin.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a pretty great instrument. I don't, you know, you could have a really cool computer, and there may be some people out there that think that's better than the Stradivarius. But I don't know. I kind of, there's something about any sort of artisan craftsmanship that, whether it's a computer or something made with hands or machined, that kind of a thing, that is really special. It's kind of hard to duplicate, especially things like a Stradivarius. You know, they still try and figure out how they were made, and there's still a lot of mystery to it, which I think is part of the charm of the instruments.
Now, when you first started out, did you start the usual path in L.A. for a composer who wants to be a film composer? You start out doing copy work, you begin doing fill-in orchestrations, or how did you get started in the business?
Yeah, for me, getting started, it was kind of that way. I don't know if there's a particular way that most people kind of get into it. I always hear different stories from different composers as far as what was their big break that got them going. For me, it was I got out of college, and I was in Las Vegas, and my grandmother lived there, and I was staying with her at a time and trying to get in the musicians union in Vegas, and they happened to have a musicians union strike the month I got there. So there was no work going on. And
was the idea you're going to be doing arranging? Or?
I thought I had this idea when I got out of college, and I have a jazz composition degree, so I was thinking I was going to be focusing on being a jazz arranger and that kind of a thing, and it's just one of those things where by the time I got out of college, I won't say jazz was dead, but it was in limbo for a while.
Well, Vegas at that time was rapidly changing because all of a sudden everything was going self-contained and the big show bands were dying out very quickly, as a matter of fact.
And so it was an interesting time. So like my first experiences were more about, okay, I need a job. So I was doing everything from being a security guard at a convention center, which didn't last very long, to I was managing Domino's Pizza restaurants for a while, which is great to learn. This is something I didn't get at Berkeley, just learning the business aspects. How do you know what your break even is as far as what your costs are versus what you need to be able to just survive? How do you promote yourself? All those kinds of basic business tools were helpful. That was a good little experience at that, and kind of worked my way to Los Angeles within a few years after being out in Vegas. And then from there, I just started playing in bands. Then I started orchestrating and copying for people. People knew that I was really good at the arranging things.
So how does that start? How do you get it? Did you meet somebody and they said,
it's
I've got a job?
It's always meeting somebody. It involves human beings.
One of the interesting things on your website, you have a blog and you say, you know, one of the things is it's really ironic that most of the time if I'm working, I'm sitting by myself in a room or with a computer or whatever, or your piano. And you're working by yourself, but the whole key to working is you have to get out and meet people, and you never know who is going to offer you that next job.
Yeah, they come from lots of unusual places, and there's no formula for it. So for me, it's a challenge because when you're working and you're busy and the schedule's crunchy and you're trying to get everything done, you don't have time to really think about, oh, I should start lining up the next two or three projects. Because you're just caught up in the middle of the focus of the work that you're doing. So it's a big challenge.
But, so I've always thought that in the film business and television film, that it's sort of an apprenticeship. You know, you show you can do copy work, then you show you can do a quick fill-in orchestrations. Is it that route, or is it far more nebulous?
You know, it's much more nebulous. I've met people who are like, yeah, some of it is, I think, a consistent thing. It is about personal relationships and building relationships. And as you build your client base, it is about meeting people. So that involves leaving the closet that you're working in and going out into the world and putting your music out there. The reality of the internet has changed a lot in the sense that it used to be you had to physically be somewhere. But now you can have a SoundCloud page, you can have a Facebook page, you can do a lot of stuff that is just web-based and get your music out there. You can have your own record label and put your music out on iTunes. So there's a lot of newer opportunities for younger writers that didn't exist when I got out of college. That's like one of those other things.
I think of somebody starting in your time where you might work under a, quote, film composer.
Yeah.
You're composing music right alongside of him, but you're also taking their thematic elements and you have to sort of make it sound like him. In a way.
Yeah, there's still a bit of that. Some of the really busy composers, there's just, you know, when the movie studio comes to, let's say, a name composer, and they say, hey, you know, we didn't really like the last score, the last composer, so our movie, we're going to put it in theaters in 3 weeks. Can you get the score done in two? You know, and it's something like 90 minutes of music. It's just physically impossible, no matter how fast you write, to write everything of 90 minutes of music in 2 weeks. So you get a lot of help. So you might sketch out sort of thematic ideas, and you just have a team of people helping you. You might have somebody who's just doing your rendering of your orchestral simulation kind of stuff on the computers. We call it mock-ups. You have some, you know, team of maybe 20 orchestrators doing all the orchestra arrangements. You have copyists, you have just teams of people making sure everything is in place, and you're working your tail off to get everything complete on time and to do really good work. So sometimes the schedules just demand that you kind of build a large team to make things happen.
Is that the way you work sometimes?
On occasion with some games, some projects are team-based. I also have a bunch of people that are really talented that help me on the what we call the music preparation side, which is, you know, the part copying. Occasionally, I love orchestrating myself, but if the schedule's really tight and crunchy, I'll focus on composition and I'll have people do the orchestrations for me. But I have a very similar style to John Williams in the sense of what I send to an orchestrator. Because I sketch everything out on paper, I use a 9-stave sketch pad. And so all the information is there. So an orchestra can look at that and they can see what the second clarinet player is assigned to do. And in some ways, that's a lot easier for them to kind of know what I'm looking for. Versus somebody that is sequencing in a computer where you have all the tracks and you have the second clarinet track. Actually, it's just the clarinet's track. It's like the whole clarinet section. And then you have somebody who has to decipher that information and say, okay, what is the second
clarinet player? What does he really want here?
Doing there? Yeah. What does the composer want? Which is a whole other skill set. So it's a little bit of a different thing. But yes, I have a team, very talented people that work with me, and they help me get what I need to get done, especially when the time frames are short.
Now, you started, I think, in video games right around 99, 2000, is that
right?
Yeah,
it was a little before 2000, like 97, I think, was when I was hired to do Outcast. And
Now, what was your first reaction? Because it's hard to remember what video games were like in 97. I think when we think of things like, you know, Mario Brothers, where, you know, these are iconic themes, but they were very rudimentary. And of course, video games now are just as, or even perhaps more complex than a film score as far as the music cues.
I think structurally, video games are more complex than film in the sense that, and this is something that I don't know if everybody really, you know, really has an idea of the differences between like scoring for film or video games. But in scoring for film, the picture is locked in time and you kind of know on the scene where it cuts to the bird in the tree, that's when the music starts. And when the mom and daughter are hugging, that's when the music ends.
And you know, it's about 1 minute and 22 seconds and it'll always be 1 minute and 22 seconds.
Yeah, 1 minute, 22 seconds and 13 frames. You know, so it's like, you know exactly what the lengths are. You know the pacing, the shape and the arc of the scene in film. In video games, it's the person playing the game that controls the pace in addition to how you program the gameplay. So it's this collaborative thing between the person who's at the end playing the game and the people who are designing the game. And when you're doing music, a lot of times I think of it more like deconstruction, that sort of art practice where you're sort of pulling things apart into their smaller elements, and then you are... in video games, what you're doing is you're using what's called a music engine, which is sort of the program that plays back the music. So iTunes is a music engine, and it's playing back music. But in video games, the music engines can be a little more complicated, where you can play things back in sort of what I would think of, I call it vertical or horizontal. So in layers of audio, and different layers can be turned on or off or faded in and faded out. Horizontal approaches are more like music is broken down into smaller components, and you play the components based on what's happening in the gameplay. So haunted house, you walk in, it's creepy. ambient music. And then when you get to, you step on a trapdoor, then that tells the programming, hey, they stepped on the trapdoor. Now play the sudden scare music or the stinger. And then the zombies come out and you have to.
And I assume if the person is making very slow progress in the game, you have to account for that player making slow progress as well as quick progress.
Sure.
Because you don't want to have sort of this endless repeat of music that, like, say, in an old-fashioned game like Mario Brothers, you knew when you were having trouble with a level, it was like, oh, I'm going to hear this music over and over again.
Yeah.
And you don't want to do that in a modern video game, do you?
No, you don't. And you do have to account for things like in the same scenario, haunted house scenario, if they never step on the trapdoor, then there's no trapdoor music or any of that. So, yeah, it is a factor that you have to consider in the design of all the music in the games. And for me, that's the best part of scoring for games is I love puzzles and challenges like that. In the same way that I love orchestration, that's a puzzle for me. I just live for that kind of thing.
My guest today is Lenny Moore, a video game, film, and television composer. He is a guest of the University of Tulsa. He's a visiting artist this weekend and will be one of the keynote speakers at the Heartland Gaming Expo Saturday, April 9th at the Rental Center, featuring a wide array of folks involved in the video game, from voiceover actors to directors. And today we're talking about the process of writing music for a video game, which it's really interesting. We think of film score as sort of the peak, but it sounds like it's even more work, more puzzles. And I assume it takes a long time to sort of track out how you do the music for a project. Or is it on the sort of same schedule as, say, film score, where sometimes you'll have 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks to put together a film score? Does it happen on that sort of track, or is it a longer process?
In general, it's a little bit of a longer process because as far as film goes, when you're doing music for a film, it's usually in the last stages of film production. So it's after they've already shot the film, they've a lot of times already done the voiceover, overdubbing, or what they call auto or ADR, automatic dialogue replacement, or something like that. It's one of the last things. So it's in the post-production phase of film. It's usually you do the music, and then they're mixing all of the audio for the film, the dialogue, sound effects, everything. Mixing it together, and then it's shipped out and distributed to movie theaters. So it's near the end of the stage in film. In video games, a lot of times I'll finish a score and it will be at the game developer's location for like up to a year after I've done finished the music and delivered it, because they're still finishing and polishing the game technologically with the programming. They're beta testing it and making sure that there's no bugs or anything like that.
Do they come back and ask you to rewrite some music or add additional music?
Yeah, occasionally there's changes in the scope of work. Sometimes they create a whole level and they go, you know, that level never worked. So we threw that out. We created a new level of gameplay, and we'd like you to write some music for it.
What's that like coming back to a project after you've been away from it for maybe up to 6 months or a year, and you go, oh, I got to get back into this?
It's fun.
Yeah, it's good. It's not not any issue.
Well, I mean, it's the equivalent of like a sequel kind of approach. If you're doing a movie and there's a sequel to it, you get to revisit material. And, you know, sometimes it's like it depends on the schedules of individual things. So let's say if you're doing a film and you get to do a sequel, but the first time you did the film, there really wasn't a whole lot of time. You know? But the second time you can kind of go, oh, yeah, I can really develop that idea more. And, you know, so for in a similar thing with video games, if you're coming back and they've added some levels, they want some additional music, you can kind of take things in a different way. And sometimes that informs what the whole music experience for the whole game is. And it helps in some ways, I think it helps the writing mature. Like sometimes it's better to just have a little more time to develop ideas, to really figure out what you're going to express and what you're going to say. And it makes the game better. And any opportunity to just have a little more time is great, but I'm happy to do it, whatever the schedule is. And I think you were asking a question earlier about sort of the planning part of it. So for me, the planning is about the same for film or video games. I always have what I call my pre-production phase before I write a note to music. And I look at the project, whatever it is, and then I think about conceptually what do I want to do, and I try and customize every score to each project. So it's unique and it really works with whatever that project is. And so I kind of figure out what I'm going to do ahead of time as far as approach, and then I basically create a plan, and then it's just about executing the plan. And it's usually stages like I'm going to have a period where I'm going to write thematic material, and then I get that to the client and get approval on what themes they really like, and then we develop that. And then while I'm doing that, it gives me time to get themes in my head and really think about how I can develop those themes in different ways. And then the next phase is just the individual cues, and that could be a film or a video game. And
well, you know, that way. And of course, with the upgrade in technology, you know, video games have changed tremendously mm-hmm. since you first started doing it.
Yeah, you mentioned
and even that. Though you know Outcast, you're using the Moscow Symphony.
Yeah, Moscow Symphony Orchestra and
Chorus. For the score, which is kind of a cool thing.
It is cool. It's kind of a landmark score in the sense that it was one of the early scores where we actually used live orchestra and choir.
And of course, that's a staple now. You know,
yeah.
I mean, and especially the orchestra and the choir with the wordless vocals, oohs and ahs.
Well, some of it's oohs and ahs, and some of it's. What was funny was with Outcast, the game developers actually made a request of me. They're like, "We would like the lyrics for the choir to be something about an adventure, and could it be in Latin?" And I was like, "Sure." And for me, the puzzle at that time was I couldn't. I was thinking of like. Sort of classic kinds of tales. So we're talking about Homer, the Odyssey, the Iliad, but that's Greek. It's not not Latin. So I was asking, this is the same friend that I mentioned earlier in the interview. His name's Kenny, and he's a very well-read guy, great guitar player. And Kenny and I were talking around that time, and I'm like, yeah, my client's asking me for like an epic tale that's in Latin. He's like, what about Virgil's The Aeneid? And I'm just like, what? I've never heard of it before. And, you know, so like Kenny turned me on to this. And then I went and got a copy of an English translation of it. And it was perfect. It was a swashbuckling tale of the founding of Rome. And it's really perfect. So what I ended up doing, this is an amazing kind of series of events. So this is the beginning of the internet, and I was looking around the internet and just looking up Virgil and the Aeneid, and I found that the University of Pennsylvania, their classics department, had a Virgil project, which was a webpage that was devoted to archiving the works of Virgil. So I contacted the head of the department and said, hey, I'm doing this video game and I love the Aeneid. I think it'll be perfect. I'd like to be able to get Latin text that I can use for a choir that's based on the original Latin. I have an English translation that I'm working off of. And he's like, oh, yeah, I think we can hook you up with somebody. So it was like his assistant was one of his former grad students, and she actually did the sort of going back to the source and getting the translations together. I had the whole it's called the Laison, which is the Latin singable version of Latin, and she just kind of went through everything with me. So that was what the choir. So they were singing about.
This is probably the only composition of. Musical composition of Virgil's Aeneid.
It may be. I know there's a lot of war requiems and things like that, but I don't think they borrowed anything from Virgil. So that was like a fun research project within. And that project was about a six-month composing process. I spent like a month or two just doing research. And then, you know, a couple of months composing and then orchestrating and all that kind of stuff. So it was just like one of those fun little things that happened when you have a little bit of time to really develop an idea.
Well, compared to that in 97 and 98 to today, mm-hmm. you know, the graphics, the visual candy of a video game is just huge. Is the same change for what you can do in a film score for a video game today? Or is it still the same sort of parameters?
Describe what you mean by the same
change.
Well,
I mean, that was obviously a big project in 97, mm-hmm. but when you hear a film score for a video game today, it's oftentimes so lush. It's like mm-hmm. very, sometimes it's very hooky depending on what the project is. You know, it could be on the radio. It could be, you know, anything else.
It's all over the map as far as it really comes from the client. It comes from the game developers or the game publishers. So, you know, I was involved on the team of, we had a nice team of about five or six people for, the anniversary issues of the Halo series.
Right.
So we did, I don't know, it was
Halo 2.
It was like 4 or 5 years ago, we did the Halo Combat Evolved, the 10-year anniversary, and then we did Halo 2 and That was also in combination with developing some material for the Master Chief Collection, which was all four of the first four Halo games for Xbox One. And so that was a team of some really talented people. So I was like the guy who was the lead orchestration, adapting the original Marty O'Donnell and Michael Salvatore scores into a little bit of a larger orchestra and adapting it so that it still honored the intention of what those guys were doing originally. So it sounds like the original concept. It's just expanded out for a slightly larger orchestra. And that was a 6-month project. So there was an equal commitment to do. And we had, like, on Halo 2 anniversary, we had similar to what was in the original Halo 2, we had a boys choir. We had the opera chorus from San Francisco. We had a full orchestra. There was a bunch of great electronic music components, and then, you know, drum programming. Just is a wide mix of things that we were doing in that game. So the big projects, like those Halo projects, Star Wars The Old Republic was a giant project, and that was like, some of the music requests are way more than film. So like Star Wars The Old Republic was like 5 hours of original orchestral music and something like a half a dozen composers working on that.
I was going to ask about that. Does it have to sort of pay homage to the Star Wars franchise and the John Williams themes, or were you able to sort of craft in your own music, really?
It depends on the project, but that one in particular, the music director gave us very clear instructions, which was, we don't want you to sound like John Williams per se. We want, this wasn't his exact words, but it's the words. This is how I sort of describe it. It's like we get to play in the Star Wars sandbox, which is, John Williams music is crucial to defining what that is. So me and the other composers had such a fun time just having these great conversations about what is Star Wars music and what does that mean. So we got great direction from the music supervisor.
Now, by contrast, you worked on something called Snoopy and the Red Baron versus the Red Baron. You use a jazz trio, which that immediately brings to mind Vince Guaraldi.
Oh, totally.
Was it solely an homage?
It wasn't even an homage. It was by design. It was like, what is Snoopy music, And the Vince Guaraldi trio is sort of the key with that's what I grew up with, as a kid,
especially a kid that loves jazz, that was probably an entree.
Loves jazz, just to hear, all those, Snoopy and Charlie Brown movies that were made. It was all the Vince Guaraldi trio and some beautiful songwriting, beautiful playing, and so it was really just kind of staying in that world and just trying to write something that was very classic in a jazz tradition of a piano trio.
Well, we wish you great success with your continuing work. You can see Lenny Moore at the Heartland Gaming Expo this Saturday at the Rental Center. Lenny, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much. It was great speaking with you.
Video game, film, television, and new media composer Lenny Moore speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be one of the keynote speakers for the Heartland Gaming Expo going on Friday and Saturday at the Rental Center. For more information on his appearance at the Gaming Expo, visit heartlandgamingexpo.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.